It's Thursday, May 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd, reporting from Washington. Coming up, Osama bin Laden's secret letters are released by the U.S. government. Some big banks are hit with big fines.
We're here to announce a major law enforcement action against international financial institutions that for years participated in a brazen display of collusion and foreign exchange rate market manipulation.
Can you clone a woolly mammoth? Some scientists say yes and no. And comedian David Letterman prepares to say goodbye to his hit television show. That's all ahead on VOA's International Edition. The U.S. government has released scores of documents it said were recovered during the 2011 raid in Pakistan that killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence said the material included personal letters to bin Laden's family, instructions to his lieutenants, and even how and when to use the Internet. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke to Seth Jones, the director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND, about what the release of these documents means.
What is the significance in a broad sense of the release of these documents? Typically, the intelligence community hasn't given their documents to the public. This time, they're doing it. Why?
Well, actually, this is part of a broader effort over the past several years to provide additional information about the way al-Qaeda's operated. There were documents released from this trove a few years ago. There have also been a number of documents released from al-Qaeda in Iraq. Many of them have gone to the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. These ones, though, were released directly on the Director of National Intelligence website.
Is there something that has changed in government operations or in the way the DNI is operating to facilitate this?
Well, look, we're living in an age where there's more access to information. In many cases, documents get released without the government's direct involvement. They get leaked in the case of Edward Snowden, for example, or with the WikiLeaks documents. In this case, these are documents that provide us a glimpse of the inner workings of al-Qaeda from its senior leadership, from Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and other senior officials. What they provide in this sense is transparency in how the organization operated. Now, it is important to recognize that this is only a very small tranche of thousands and thousands of documents from the trove captured at bin Laden's complex. So it's important to keep that in context and looking at these ones that are released.
We don't know what these documents are at this point. What if there are, for instance, documents that show cooperation or collusion by various governments or various actors or entities? This is kind of interesting because in releasing these documents, might there be some embarrassments?
Well, I haven't seen anything along those lines in these particular documents. There may be that kind of information in other documents that have not been released. Most of this information appears to be communications among al-Qaeda leaders and affiliates in places like North Africa. They discuss issues like the Arab uprisings and how to take advantage of them. So these are really, most of them are strategic-level documents not implicating neighboring governments, with the exception of some interesting information on some of the al-Qaeda affiliates that were and members and family members that were in Iran.
What is the public's benefit by this release? Is there any takeaway to this, or is it just a matter of transparency?
Well, I think it is important to understand an organization that continues to threaten the United States and the West more broadly, and not just the West, but also threaten a range of countries in Africa, in the Middle East, South Asia, and the broader Asia-Pacific Rim. The rise of the Daesh or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, there are a number of other organizations in addition to al-Qaeda that are providing a threat. The more we can understand these kinds of organizations, I think the better educated the population in these various areas can be. And what you really gauge, frankly, is that this is a social movement that's not going to go away anytime in the foreseeable future. And that's what people should come away with in understanding.
For more on this story, you can always log on to our website, www.voanews.com. Speaking of our website, for a look at how the Internet and social media are responding to this story, here's VOA's Michael Lippin. Michael, what are people saying about this story?
Thanks, David. Well, I can tell you our report about the U.S. releasing documents recovered during the bin Laden raid is the top story on our website right now, and it's attracted a couple of comments from our readers. Some of them don't think it was a good idea for the U.S. government to actually declassify this material. Reader Chris Mary from Abuja, Nigeria wrote, "This is not good for public consumption. May God protect us all." Another reader by the name of Brandon had some advice for U.S. officials, saying, "It's far wiser to remain silent on certain matters, and this is definitely one of them. It's doubtful whether the British government or the Russians would ever release documents such as this." That's Brandon's view. A third reader, Nash Davu from the Nigerian city of Jos, appealed to God to bring peace to the world and to help protect it from all forms of terrorism. Now, the VOA article also appeared on the Voice of America Facebook page, where several users gave their opinions of the former al-Qaeda chief. Urim Urimi Halimi from Brussels, Belgium wrote, "Legends never die, hashtag respect." Another Facebook user, Rajendra Prasad Kandel from the Nepalese capital Kathmandu, had an opposing view of bin Laden, writing, "Terrorists have a tragic end." Well, the bin Laden documents also have been a hot topic on Twitter. Analytics website Topsy says the words bin Laden have been mentioned in at least 46,000 tweets in the past day. David?
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. That's VOA's Michael Lippin. And we invite your comments on our stories. Just go to www.voanews.com.
What's new from VOA?
Do you still have a vinyl record collection? Some audiophiles say they prefer the sound of vinyl over digitized music. And records are making a comeback among younger listeners. Now a company in Japan is making turntables that can preserve and improve music on vinyl. Laser turntables. No metal stylus touches the record. And the laser sends pure analog audio to your sound system.
Music in vinyl records is more valuable than money.
ELP President Sanju Chiba says that's because analog music is more natural than digitized sound. His company's turntable focuses lasers on the parts of the grooves untouched by a needle. He says the sound is similar to the music of the master tape. The device doesn't come cheap. The base model is $14,000. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's What's New.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Five of the world's largest banks face nearly $6 billion in penalties for illegally colluding to manipulate prices in currency exchange. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said Wednesday that the fines were intended to show that no one is immune when it comes to currency manipulation.
Today's historic resolutions are the latest in our ongoing efforts to investigate and prosecute financial crimes, and they serve as a stark reminder that this Department of Justice intends to vigorously prosecute all those who tilt the economic system in their favor, who subvert our marketplaces, and who enrich themselves at the expense of the American consumer.
For insight on this story, our economics editor, Jim Randall, joins me in the studio. Jim, why is this important? What were these banks doing that was worthy of these fines?
Well, we trust, as customers, we trust that the price we get when we buy or sell dollars or euros or whatever is being set by the market, not being set by collusion. And they violated that basic belief. And this is a zero-sum game. If they make more money, that means you and I make less.
U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said the fines were justified because the prices that we are to expect are supposed to be adjusted by the market. But is this really going to hurt these banks? I mean, these are the kind of institutions like Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase and Royal Bank of Scotland that deal with trillions and trillions of dollars every day.
The fines are big enough that they will definitely be noticed, and there's a lot of speculation in the financial press that some of the top executives of these very large companies will get fired or resign or be forced to resign.
How does this affect the overall financial market? Can people trust that when they do these exchanges that they will be actual, honest currency-to-currency exchanges?
I kind of hope so. It's hard to say. I spoke with one analyst who said there are technical changes that you could make. It's very complicated, but you could make some technical changes that would make it more difficult to manipulate currencies, and perhaps that might go into effect in the wake of this.
All right. That's VOA's economics editor, Jim Randall. For more on this story, please log on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. Speaking of currencies, top officials of the U.S. Central Bank appeared unlikely to raise the key interest rate in June, as some analysts had expected. Notes from the most recent meeting at the U.S. Federal Reserve show that officials tried to make sense of disappointing recent economic data that show the economy is growing more slowly than expected. The summary was made public Wednesday after a three-week delay. The next scheduled meeting of the committee that sets interest rates is on June 16th and 17th. Coming up, can you clone a mammoth? Well, we'll find out from Roseanne Scurble. But first, here's Dave DeForest with a look at what's making news.
Here are the headlines from VOA. The U.S. government has released scores of documents it says were recovered during that raid that killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. The material includes personal letters, a list of English language books recovered from his compound, think tank studies, technical manuals, and material published by other militant groups. The Islamic State has apparently captured the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian forces had withdrawn from nearly the entire city by late Wednesday after heavy fighting. Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Wednesday international inspectors will not be given access to his country's scientists or military sites under any nuclear agreement. He also said Iran will not give in to excessive demands. I'm Dave DeForest, VOA News.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, could mammoth clones roam the earth anytime soon? And David Letterman calls it a career after 33 years behind the desk. That's all ahead. Stay tuned. One of the summer blockbusters highly expected this year is another Jurassic Park film. You'll remember in the first films, they took dinosaur DNA and recreated the giant reptiles who've been extinct for millions of years. But could you really do that? Could you bring a creature that has been long gone back to life? Well, that's a question that's answered in a new book, How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction, by author and scientist Beth Shapiro. Roseanne Scurble interviewed Ms. Shapiro. Roseanne, can this actually happen?
Not exactly.
What is she talking about in this book?
Basically, you cannot clone a mammoth because there are no live mammal cells. So you can't do it. It's impossible to clone it, like Dolly was cloned in the mid-1990s.
Dolly the sheep.
Dolly the sheep was cloned and lived about 6 years. But what she's talking about in this book, and she talks about mammoths, but other animals as well, is that you can take the genomic sequence and that DNA and then take its closest relative, animal relative, which is an Asian elephant. You could insert by cutting and pasting, genetic engineering, if you will, and grow bit by bit this new animal that is something mammoth-like. But to bring back a mammoth, no.
Okay, so is there a move to do this kind of thing, or is this just more theoretical?
There is a group, actually, at Harvard University that is interested in this. But not exactly for the reasons the Jurassic Park idea, to bring back a freak show, as it were. What they're thinking of is if you can bring back the traits of a mammoth, you may be able to engineer those into creatures that are on the brink, endangered, or in danger of threatened or endangered of going extinct.
Now, has this kind of thing been done with anything that we could look at now, or is this just something
This is something that genetics and the science of genetics is working out in that realm, and backbreeding. But you know, you have to ask a lot of questions. Why would you do this? Why would I think that what people are hopefully realizing is that we are a part of nature. We are not the masters of nature. We're finding this out with climate change and how our environments are changing. So why would you really, really want to do this? And the way the author, again, answers that question is that we can help in a conservation way. In that way, she says, it's a very powerful tool. But is there a place for it? How would bringing back species affect ecosystems? And is it even technically possible? They're so far away from it now. It's a long way. But the exercise is worth it, in the sense that they are looking at characteristics of traits that might be useful in helping support species that are alive today.
All right, that is Roseanne Skirbel. You can see her report about this subject by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. And in the search engine, just look for the word mammoth. I'm David Byrd in Washington. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
After 33 years, 16 Emmy Awards, and more than 6,000 broadcasts, legendary broadcaster David Letterman is calling it a career with his final show. But what does Letterman's career mean for television and for the talk show itself? To talk about that, I'm joined by Ron Simon, who's a curator at the Paley Center for Media in New York. Mr. Simon, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
David Letterman, what does his career mean for broadcasting and for the talk show format in particular?
Well, certainly David Letterman has had a remarkable career. He begins in the analog television days. In fact, he comes out of broadcasting so that he knew all the rules of comedy and talk show. He certainly learned so much from his mentor, Johnny Carson. But the thing about David Letterman is that then he broke all those rules so that he's the bridge to two different generations of comedians. He's the one who absorbed everything you needed to know for the first era of television, and then he brought a whole new hip sensibility to another era of television.
He also was famous for some of the bits like stupid human tricks or stupid pet tricks or running over blank with a steamroller or dropping something off the top of a building in Midtown Manhattan to see what would happen. Is that reflective more of who he is, or do you think that those were things that you mentioned he broke the rules and so he just did them to kind of wink and stick it in the public's eye a little bit?
No, I think there's a quiet rebelliousness to David Letterman. He was someone who always wanted to push the limits of comedy. And you have to remember that when he began his late-night talk show on NBC, it began at 12:35, he was the first person to ever do a talk show that late. So he was given freedom to develop a different type of way of relating to the audience. Originally, he was told just to relate to the young male college audience, so that he was able to think about comedy very differently. Then he brought a lot of those experiments to a more mainstream audience when he joined CBS in the early 90s.
And it wasn't just comedy. He was also known for his very poignant reflections on 9/11, for introducing his heart surgeons when he had quintuple bypass surgery, and for making a public admission of having had an extramarital affair and apologizing to his wife. There's very few people who would do that, and very few, if any, other talk show hosts.
You know, the nice thing about David Letterman, you could see him mature over the years. Certainly when he was on NBC, he portrayed himself very isolated, very maladroit at any type of social connections. He was very uncomfortable in his own skin. But during the CBS years, you saw that he took on larger challenges, and he revealed more of himself, certainly with big historical events like 9/11, and also more personal turmoil, whether it be his surgery or his problems with the extramarital affair. But he was able to, I guess, grow more comfortable in himself to talk to the audience about more private, personal matters.
All right, that is Ron Simon. He's a curator at the Paley Center for Media, and he spoke to us from New York City. Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. To see videos or photos from some of the stories you heard on our show, log on to our website, www.voanews.com. That's also where you can post your questions or comments. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Today's program was directed by Tracy Carter. Aydin Erkut was our engineer. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political turmoil continues in Burundi, with top government officials being dismissed following a short-lived effort by some military officers to take over the government. On May 17th, 5 days after the takeover attempt, President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree relieving the foreign, defense, and commerce ministers of their duties. Even as the president made his first public appearance in Bujumbura to show he was back in command, street protests continued there over his plans to run for a third term. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. Announcement of President Nkurunziza's candidacy triggered street protests, which police tried to repress with water cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. Estimates are that up to 20 people have been killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds detained over almost 4 weeks of demonstrations. Meanwhile, intimidation and violence by the ruling party's youth militia ahead of the planned May 26 legislative and June 26 presidential elections have caused tens of thousands of Burundians to flee to neighboring nations. The United States is deeply concerned by the potential for further bloodshed, including reports of retaliatory violence following the attempted seizure of power. We urge all parties to seek reconciliation and unity over revenge and retribution during this extremely tense period. We have acted to restrict travel for Burundian individuals who reportedly have committed human rights abuses and will consider additional measures against anyone who plans, participates in, or orders widespread or systematic discriminatory violence against the civilian population. The United States supports no effort by the military to take over power by unlawful means. We continue to believe that adhering to the compromises contained in the Arusha Agreement, including its presidential term limits provision, is key to returning stability and unity to Burundi. Thus, we hope that President Nkurunziza will weigh the best interests of his country and his legacy as he considers whether to continue his controversial bid for a third term. His candidacy will undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress. Some international donors have already cut or suspended financial aid. The United States welcomes the mediation efforts by the United Nations and African Union and urges all Burundian stakeholders to participate constructively to find a peaceful, democratic resolution to the current crisis. We particularly welcome the announcement by the International Conference on the Great Lakes Region of the visit of the presidents of South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania to Bujumbura in the coming days to meet with all parties. Burundi has come far since the end of the last civil war that caused so many deaths and human suffering. The United States reiterates its strong support for the people of Burundi at this very difficult time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. We come to you 7 days each week with interesting stories from around the world. And we always speak slowly and use words that are easy to understand. Today we have two stories for you. The first one involves Cambodia, Australia, and people seeking asylum. Then some news from the world of science. Experts say that something very small that often serves as food for sea animals has a much more important purpose than previously known. So let's get ready to listen and learn. Here is part one. 4 asylum seekers arrived in Cambodia last week. They are the first asylum seekers from an Australian-operated camp on the Pacific island nation of Nauru. The island nation has been holding them for the Australian government. The refugees were denied permission to settle in Australia. Under a secretive deal, Australia agreed to pay Cambodia $32 million for accepting the refugees. Mario Ritter has more.
The details of the deal were kept in secret. Even the arrival of the 4 asylum seekers in Phnom Penh was kept out of sight of reporters. The 4 individuals left the city's airport in a vehicle whose windows were covered up. The refugees are an Iranian man and his wife, a second man, also from Iran, and an ethnic Rohingya man from Myanmar. They were taken to a house in Phnom Penh, where they will live for the next year. Under the deal, Australia will pay all resettlement costs for a year. Those refugees who accept will receive thousands of dollars in payments, language and skills training, and health care. The deal has been strongly criticized both in Australia and overseas. Phil Robertson is the Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division. He says Cambodia is a poor choice for refugee resettlement because of its recent treatment of refugees from Vietnam and China.
Cambodia clearly has no will or capacity to integrate refugees permanently into Cambodian society. These 4 refugees are essentially human guinea pigs in an Australian experiment that ignores the fact that Cambodia has not integrated other refugees and has already sent Montagnards and Uyghur asylum seekers back into harm's way in Vietnam and China.
He warns that the deal between Australia and Cambodia will likely harm refugee rights across Southeast Asia. An Australian Immigration Department press officer who traveled to Cambodia with the 4 individuals refused to speak to reporters in Phnom Penh. The Australian government is paying the International Organization for Migration, the IOM, to look after the refugees. Given the sensitive issue, is the IOM concerned about its image? Joe Lowry works for the group.
And we genuinely believe that this is the best option for these people at the moment. They're not going to get to Australia, so it's the only choice they have is stay on Nauru or come to Cambodia.
Australia hopes their experience will persuade some of the hundreds still on Nauru to consider giving up on their dream of living in Australia. In a video in April, Australia's Immigration Minister Peter Dutton told the detainees their choices were limited to remaining on Nauru for another 10 years or moving to Cambodia.
I want to make it very clear to all refugees and transferees in Nauru that you will not, under any circumstances, be settling in Australia. This is not an option that the Australian government will ever present to you. Cambodia provides you with a chance to start afresh, a chance to begin a new life. This is your only long-term settlement option.
More than 600 refugees and asylum seekers are thought to be living in Nauru. Hundreds more are in detention on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island under an agreement with Australia. Most are believed to be from South Asia or the Middle East. The proposed resettlement deal was the subject of months of secret negotiations. It has received criticism from rights organizations, religious groups, and opposition politicians in both countries. Rights groups say Mr. Dutton's description of Cambodia as a land of safety, security, and opportunity is untrue. His comments conflict with the Australian government's own advice to Australians thinking of visiting the country. Some Cambodians also are unhappy. Their homeland has high levels of corruption, poor education and health care systems, and no social programs to help the very poor. The Cambodians cannot understand why foreign nationals will get money and help that are unavailable to them and other citizens. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. For years, most people thought of small organisms called plankton as food for whales and other large sea animals. But a four-year-long study discovered that plankton are a major supplier of oxygen on our planet. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
Plankton are a group of different ocean creatures, algae, bacteria, and other organisms. They live close to the water's surface in oceans, seas, and lakes. Plankton cannot be seen without a microscope, but they are the main source of food for larger animals like whales. Recently, 200 scientists from 45 countries took turns researching plankton on a two-mast schooner. The boat set sail in September 2009. It visited 210 areas. The scientists collected 35,000 samples of plankton. The researchers followed the lives of plankton, examined their genetic material, and watched their movements. A French nonprofit group called Tara Expeditions launched the project known as Tara Oceans. Chris Bowler was the project's scientific coordinator. He says the researchers found that plankton are very important to the health of our planet.
Generating the oxygen we breathe, removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and generally maintaining this Earth in a state that is habitable for us human beings.
Mr. Bowler says almost half of the oxygen we breathe comes from very small algae called diatoms. These plants live in the part of the water where the sun reaches.
That basically means every fifth time that you breathe, you're breathing oxygen, which we can directly trace back to diatoms. So they're sort of as important as a tropical rainforest in terms of their global contribution.
Romain Troublet is the executive director of Tara Oceans. He believes the study shows that the ocean greatly affects the Earth's climate.
We believe that the ocean is also a main driver of the climate change, a main mitigator in the way that the ocean and the life in the ocean is storing carbon dioxide, storing heat. And this machinery works because the ocean is in good health.
Different groups of researchers studied different things. One group identified more than 40 million plankton genes formerly unknown to scientists. The collected information will be used to identify which of the plankton have little or no trouble reacting to changing water conditions. Results of the study appeared in the online scientific journal Science. The publication says many experts will be examining the study. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
This is VOA, the voice of America in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. For the past 15 years, experts on obesity have gathered in Plymouth, England to attend a conference. It is estimated that more than half the city's adults are overweight or obese. The rest of Britain is not doing much better. But what is happening in the UK is also happening in the US and other Western countries, as well as in a growing number of developing nations. VOA's Joe DiCapua talked with the expert who chaired the conference called the Plymouth Symposium on Obesity, Diabetes, and Metabolic Syndrome. Jonathan Pinkney is a professor of endocrinology and diabetes at Plymouth University. Professor Pinkney said obesity is a long-term problem that is very difficult to solve. He said no one health issue has more impact on human health than obesity. Professor Pinkney called obesity a complex issue involving more than what a person eats.
I personally feel that this is such a wide field. There's so many issues. There's politics, there's biology, and there's the food industry. There's everything you could imagine. So I think it's right to talk about everything under one umbrella.
Mr. Pinkney says obesity can interfere and impair the ability to have a normal life. Mr. Pinkney warns that even people who are not considered obese can still be at risk. He said many people eat the wrong foods and do not get enough physical activity. People have been getting heavier and heavier slowly over time, he said, and that's a problem.
That's the more important point for the health of the population. You know, all the diabetes and heart attacks and cancers and things. I mean, that's really caused by lower levels of weight gain.
The conference provided much information about the biology of the brain and appetite control. The professor said people know how to eat healthy, but this knowledge is often overtaken by marketing of the food industry. Advertisers show food on television and in print in a way that creates immediate desire. Professor Pinkney said these images can lead some people to eat unhealthy foods. The expert argued that the obesity epidemic must be stopped at its source, when eating habits begin. Children, he said, often learn poor eating habits from their parents. The professor suggests one way to improve the situation. He said children should be protected from advertising and marketing put out by the food industry. Besides marketing campaigns, the professor also blames refined carbohydrates and sugars for much of the obesity epidemic. Refining is a process that removes fiber, nutrients, and other items contained within the food in its natural state. Refining also concentrates sugars and can cause our blood sugar levels to change more rapidly than normal. Without complex fiber, these foods do not satisfy a person's hunger for long. So, people eat their next meal sooner than normal. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. On a cold October day in 1957, the Soviet Union launched a small satellite into orbit around the Earth. Radio Moscow made the announcement.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
The world's first satellite was called Sputnik 1. Sputnik was an important propaganda victory for the Soviets in the Cold War with the United States. Many people believed the nation that controlled space could win any war, and the Soviet Union had reached outer space first. The technology that launched Sputnik probably began in the late 19th century. A Russian teacher of that time, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, decided that a rocket engine could provide power for a space vehicle. In the early 1900s, another teacher, American Robert Goddard, tested the idea. He experimented with small rockets to see how high and how far they could travel. In 1923, a Romanian student in Germany, Hermann Oberth, showed how a spaceship might be built and launched to other planets. Rocket technology improved during World War II. It was used to produce flying bombs. Thousands of people in Britain and Belgium died as a result of V-1 and V-2 rocket attacks. The rockets were launched from Germany. The larger V-2 rocket had the ability to hit the United States. After the war, it became clear that the United States and the Soviet Union, allies in wartime, would become enemies in peacetime. So both countries employed German scientists to help them win the race to space. The Soviets took the first step by creating Sputnik. This satellite was about the size of a basketball. It got its power from a rocket. It orbited Earth for 3 months. Within weeks, the Soviets launched another satellite into Earth orbit, Sputnik 2. It was much bigger and heavier than Sputnik 1. It also carried a passenger, a dog named Laika. Laika orbited Earth for 7 days. The United States joined the space race about 3 months later. It launched a satellite from Cape Canaveral in the southeastern state of Florida. The satellite was called Explorer 1. It weighed about 14 kilograms. Explorer 1 went into a higher orbit than either Sputnik, and its instruments made an important discovery. They found an area of radiation about 960 kilometers above Earth. The next major space victory belonged to the Soviets. They sent the first man into space. In April 1961, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was launched in the vehicle known as Vostok. He remained in space for less than 2 hours. he landed safely by parachute near a village in Russia. Less than a month later, the United States sent its first astronaut into space. He was Alan Shepard. Shepard remained in space only about 15 minutes. He did not go into Earth orbit. That flight came in February 1962 with John Glenn. By 1965, the United States and the Soviet Union were experimenting to see if humans could survive outside a spacecraft. In March, Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov became the first person to do so. A strong tether connected Leonov to the spacecraft. The tether gave him oxygen to breathe, and it permitted him to float freely at the other end. After about 10 minutes, Leonov had to return to the spacecraft. He said he regretted the decision. He was having such a good time. A little more than 2 months later, an American would walk outside his spacecraft. Astronaut Edward White had a kind of rocket gun. This gave him some control of his movements in space. Like Leonov, White was sorry when he had to return to his spacecraft. Later that year, 1965, the United States tried to have one spacecraft get very close to another spacecraft while in orbit. This was the first step in getting spacecraft to link or dock together. Docking would be necessary to land men on the moon. The plan called for a Gemini spacecraft carrying two astronauts to get close to an unmanned satellite. The attempt failed. The target satellite exploded as it separated from its main rocket. America's space agency decided to move forward. It would launch the next in its Gemini series. Then someone had an idea. Why not launch both Geminis? The second one could chase the first one instead of a satellite. Again, things did not go as planned. It took two tries to launch the second Gemini. By that time, the first one had been in orbit about 11 days. Time was running out. The astronauts on the second Gemini moved their spacecraft into higher orbits. They got closer and closer to the Gemini ahead of them. They needed to get within 600 meters to be considered successful. After all the problems on the ground, the events in space went smoothly. The two spacecraft got within one-third of a meter of each other. The astronauts had made the operation seem easy. In January 1959, the Soviets launched a series of unmanned lunar rockets. The third of these flights took pictures of the far side of the moon. This was the side no one on Earth had ever seen. The United States planned to explore the moon with its unmanned Ranger spacecraft. There were a number of failures before Ranger 7 took pictures of the moon. These pictures were made from a distance. The world did not get pictures from the surface of the moon until the Soviet Luna 9 landed there in February 1966. For the next few years, both the United States and the Soviet Union continued their exploration of the moon. Yet the question remained, which one would be the first to put a man there? In December 1968, the United States launched Apollo 8 with three astronauts. The flight proved that a spacecraft could orbit the moon and return to Earth safely. The Apollo 9 spacecraft had two vehicles. One was the command module. It could orbit the moon, but could not land on it. The other was the lunar module. On a flight to the moon, it would separate from the command module and land on the moon's surface. Apollo 10 astronauts unlinked the lunar module and flew it close to the moon's surface. After those flights, everything was ready.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running.
On July 16, 1969, three American astronauts lifted off in Apollo 11. On the 20th, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin entered the lunar module called the Eagle. Michael Collins remained in the command module, the Columbia. The two vehicles separated.
25 feet. That's looking good. Down a half.
It was a dangerous time. The Eagle could crash, or it could fall over after it landed. That meant the astronauts would die on the moon.
Four forward, drift into the right a little. 30 seconds forward.
Millions of people watched on television or listened on the radio. They waited for Armstrong's message.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. Then they waited again. It took the astronauts more than 3 hours to complete the preparations needed to leave the lunar module. Finally, the door opened. Neil Armstrong climbed down first. He put one foot on the moon, then the other foot, and then came his words from so far away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man on the moon.
Oh, boy. Boy.
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
CBS television newsman Walter Cronkite shared the excitement that he and so many people felt as man first walked on the surface of the moon. Later, Cronkite would remember the historical significance of that moment in 1969.
It was hard, I think, to imagine our emotions at the moment. It really was something that had to grip you. It was as if you could have stood at the dock and waved goodbye to Columbus. You knew darn good and well that this was the real history in the making.
Armstrong walked around. Soon, Aldrin joined him.
They're setting up the flag now.
The two men placed an American flag on the surface of the moon. They also collected moon rocks and soil. When it was time to leave, they returned to the Eagle and guided it safely away. They reunited with the Columbia and headed for home. The United States had won the race to the moon.
The thing that made this one particularly gripping was that sense of history, that if this was successful, this was a date that was going to be in all of the history books from time evermore. I think we sensed that at the time, just sitting there at the Cape and watching that great beast get on its way, that this was it.
You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.